Hello, this is Peter Hill Explains, and let's have a scientific conversation. In terms of the 2014 HSC Physics exam, the Quantum Quark section. I'm doing this over and over again, different sections, so I can build up my skill. And the way that it goes is that I read the question once, two questions once, and then give a generalized talk. Go through the formula sheet, read the questions again, hit the actual answers, and then compare with the given answers. And if they're wrong, I'll tell you them, and we'll post it a separate explanation of how they're wrong in the... I'll just read it to you. It'll be fairly obvious if they're wrong. I'll just post it in the bloopers section. I've got another bloopers podcast running parallel to this. No further ado, let's read the question first off. A, part one, a photon is emitted when an electron in a hydrogen atom transitions from the N equals 3 excited state to the ground state. Calculate the wavelength of the photon. Two, a photon, which is presumably the same one referred to before, is incident on a hydrogen atom in the ground state. Explain, using de Broglie's hypothesis, why the photon is not absorbed by the hydrogen atom. B, the second question. Outline why gravitational forces are irrelevant in the nucleus of an atom. 2. The graph shows the binding energy per nucleon. So on the left, or the vertical axis, it's got MeV. Of binding energy, the energy if you add an extra nucleon to it, and on the base it's got atomic number, so it starts from hydrogen, and then you get energy for helium going up to iron, which is the most stable, and then going down to iron, which is the least stable. That's going to be a bit difficult to explain. Okay, part two, the lecture. So a photon, so just to clue you in, the lectures are a little bit higher than school work. So a photon or wavelengths or electromagnetic radiation is emitted by antenna and received by antenna. An antenna has the fundamental property of accelerating charge. And given in quantum mechanics, the electrons aren't not necessarily moving, but there is such thing as a dipole transition moment. This is as the electron changes shape. This is the full blown quantum physics, and then we'll go back to the what's taught at school. So as the electron will have a certain shape, modal shape, and adopts a new modal shape. It will do that by releasing a quantum of angular momentum, and that is right. The light is quantized in terms of angular momentum. It has an angular momentum of plus or minus 1. The allowed states are 0, plus or minus 1, but the 0 photon actually doesn't escape. It's actually bound inside the atom. So the atom will slowly pulsate and gyrate and transition from one state to the next, and as it does so, you get the wavefronts of the photon being emitted out from it. And so in quantum mechanics, the states have certain fold lines. They're nice small fold lines, and the important thing to say is that the electrons aren't actually a greater net radius in the higher states. They can actually be in quite a close radius, and they actually there are no surfaces in quantum mechanics, and they actually fold through each other. This is some of the hard things to get through. The electron in quantum mechanics is large as an atom, where things which are heavy or more massive, like the neutrons and protons, they're really small. So Schrodinger wave equation has a size, you know, really crudely, a size equals 1 on m. So the greater the mass, the smaller it is. Just to let you into it. So going back to school, the original diagram, which is rather nice, is to draw a tiny little dot and for the nucleus, which is positively charged, and the electron moves around the outside, and it moves at radiuses. It's called a Rydberg atom, which is an atom which Bohr has described, but there's, I suppose, the Rydberg atom refers to a certain class. The full Bohr atom and the Rydberg atom are the same, but the Rydberg atom, people just historically tend to talk about it and sort of scratch their head about it, because the Rydberg atom has a radius at atoms, the ground state, which is the Bohr radius. The next radius is 4 times out, and that doesn't look too weird. The next one is 9 times further out. Again, that looks a little bit weird. The one after that, you can guess it is 16. And by the time you get up to the 10th state, it's 100 times further out. The actual spacing starts to really step out. And if you draw the energy levels on a 1R squared potential, well, that's the force, 1R potential, which is the electrostatic potential between an electron and a positive nucleus, you will see that that actually does make sense. The actual, I suppose, the energy really drops as the quantum states go out, going out. Oh, I can't do too much quantum mechanics with you, can I? But yeah, so this is getting back to the Bohr atom. And so the Bohr atom has these fixed orbitals, and Bohr couldn't get it to work. He scratched his head and he said, look, I'm going to have postulates that the electron can, whoop, disappear from the universe. Where's it gone? Oh, it's over here. It's a little like a children's pantomime with electrons disappearing from the universe and reappearing elsewhere. And to do it, they magically emit photons going in and out of it. So when something drops from a high state to a low state, it emits a photon, but a photon can actually reverse it, and actually it can absorb. So this is the entire thing of absorbing photons. In quantum mechanics, it's really clear. In Bohr's atom, it's just all done by proof by intimidation, we used to call it, at university, where there's actually no proof there. But quantum mechanics does have the proof for it. And now, de Broglie had a hypothesis that lambda equals h on m times v, the momentum. So you could actually put in the calculated velocity of a classical electron at a particular orbit and get the wavelength of it out, and then you'd see, so the wavelength actually increases as you go to further orbits, because the electron is more travelling more slowly as it's going around. It's a very interesting thing. So the actual wavelength of the electron increases as you go out to different orbits, and there's a sort of a mathematical trick when you get really into the equations going through de Broglie's hypothesis, which says that the wavelength increases, but the orbit length increases, and so it's just everything's hunky-dory, that N2 orbit, which is 4 times as long, it needs to have twice as 2 wavelengths, but it's also expanded by that similar factor of 4. So it's, how do you say it? You need a factor of 2, and it's also manages to fit in there, so just get your head around it. So often people draw these orbits not in the correct de Broglie, the correct Rydberg, increasing one on n squared, increasing on n squared, and therefore there's a bit of a sleight of hand trying to show you what's going on. That's it. You'll have to do it. So just to go through a game, Bohr got up to an electron in an orbit, and he couldn't explain why there couldn't be more than one electron. Well, there's only one electron in an orbit because he only did a one electron atom, but if there's two electrons, he had to struggle, and he had to introduce Pauli's exclusion principle to have their shell occupancy. So people very early on at school know you to draw a nucleus and four circles around you, go up to four, and fill those orbitals on a 2-8-8-2 method, and I've given it a YouTube on it. Just to go up, we're going to talk about the nucleus of the atom. So the nucleus of the atom is this tiny thing, a billionth the size of the whole atom, and it contains neutrons, neutrons and protons. And there's several forces at play in a nucleus. Those who are more a fae, that'll be the strong nuclear force, which actually binds neutrons and protons together in the centre of the nucleus. And if you really go into it, there's at school they still teach the Yagawa potential, with this ancient idea that the nucleus, the neutrons and protons, have a repulsive force; they can't actually overlap with each other. And we just sort of quietly put that to a side and say, yes, well, in quantum physics, they do overlap with each other and come up with the Saxon-Woods potential. And this is in quantum mechanics, things can actually slide through each other. So in quantum mechanics, say if you've got two cups, the two cups can actually slide through each other like ghosts. But that's the way it is. This is Pedicle Explains, where I try just be honest with you. There. So the school view of it is that they're like marbles, and so marbles which stick together for a certain amount but then repel each other so they don't all collapse to each other. It's a bit of a head-scratching thing, so you get a lot of phony stuff. And so you've got the inside of the quarks held together by gluons, and then there's a similar a strong nuclear force holding these neutrons and protons together at very short range. The protons then want to escape from each other, and so you can have a repulsive potential. So it's attractive and repulsive after a certain distance, and this can actually create a potential energy barrier. That is, they can be at an excited state within this potential. And to draw a line across, say you draw a potential barrier which goes from minus infinity up, starts to go up a tiny little bit due to the Coulomb repulsions, rises up above zero, and then plunges down to zero. Now, and then the Saxon-Woods potential is flat at the bottom, the Yagawa potential has a little spike up the top for some reason, unknown reason. But then that's repeated symmetrically on the other side. But now, in order to get energy levels, it has to be quantized, and you can say that a alpha particle is sitting high up above, so it wants an alpha particle, wants to escape the nucleus, and it will tunnel through the nuclear wall. That's classically, and there's a quantum mechanical story behind it. The story for the explanation of beta decay, or I suppose you can, emission of neutrons and protons are pretty much the same thing. A neutron really has no reason to. If you do have some neutron emitters, and that's a real head scratcher if you do it classical physics, because you can have neutrons and protons above, sitting up above the zero energy level and the raised up due to the Coulombic repulsion, but however they're not involved in the Coulombic repulsion because they don't feel a charge. So there's that complexity. You also have the emission of beta particles, which is electrons. Either a neutron turns into a proton with the emission of an electron, or a proton can turn into a neutron with the emission of a positron. You get positron emissions, and that's sort of hard to understand unless you do the full quantum mechanics and answer it through. Now, there's that force. I've talked about the other force, the mass of the force, the gravitational mass. Even though it's a really close distance, the gravitational constant is much lower. The G, big capital G, is orders of magnitude smaller. So there's these forces involved. There's also gravity involved. Then we have basically you've got this potential in here, and you can, like dropping electrons into an atom, you can drop nucleons into a strong nuclear force potential, and it has the advantage that if the potential is not good enough, you can add a few more neutrons, and the potential deepens a little bit, and so you can pop it in, and then as you add more nucleons in, more neutrons, then more protons, that effect reduces. You get the Coulombic force pushing it away. The Coulombic forces push up, and the benefit of adding a neutron or a proton doesn't actually increase the strong nuclear force. So it's a rather confusing thing that the actual potential before is actually rather simple to calculate, but it's a really complicated thing to actually work out what's going on. I haven't read a paper for a number of years how that's like some bricks. So you can't use the nuclear potential of a helium for a carbon, for instance. You've got to recalculate it each time, but you can still work it out what it is. So it's a complex thing. So what happens is that initially, when you add nucleons together, you get energy released up to iron, which is the most stable iron, 26 off the top of my head. And then, as you add more nucleons, it becomes less stable until you make something obscene like uranium, which is 92, 235, 238, depends on. 235 is the fissionable isotope. 238, if you add a neutron to it, it won't fuse, but it'll eventually go through at neptunium up to plutonium, so it won't fuse, but it will, so it won't I say fuse, fission, break in two. 235 will break in two most of the time. Sometimes it hangs around to 336, and then if you that's unstable, radioactive, but then if you add more neutrons again, that once you get to 336, it hangs around and makes plutonium 239. This is a different type of plutonium as you get up to it here. So the major thing is, if you fission, you break it up, you get a more favorable, you get lighter unit nuclei, which have a more favorable energy per nucleons. The same number of nucleons are there, so therefore you get more energy out from it. So that ends the lecture. As promised, I'm going to read through the formula sheet again. I'll do it rather quickly here. This is all formula relevant to this topic. For the force in a magnetic field, this is neutrons. Sorry, this is alpha particles, beta particles in cloud chambers. You've got the force on the particle is qv times the velocity of the particle. B in Tesla, sine theta, the angle to the actual field, and the force is in newtons, and then you that will tend to make it go in circular motion. It will accelerate, and it will be a centripetal acceleration of mv squared on r to work out what's going on. You also have the electric field equals the voltage on the distance, all in meters, volts, and electric field is in basically volts per meter. Again, you might need that to stabilize something. And then you have similar equation, energy equals Planck's constant times frequency. Planck's constant in units of action, which is joule seconds, is a unit of action, which is the integration of a Lagrangian over time. and times frequency. So if I've got a photon of a particular frequency, I can put that frequency in and get out an energy. C equals F lambda. So F, the frequency, times the wavelength equals C, obviously for a light particle. Nothing else travels at the speed of light. Here's an interesting thing, which is the Rydberg equation, because the Rydberg equation is being generated from the age of spectroscopes, which gave out wavelengths. So one on the wavelength equals the Rydberg constant, which will be given to you. One on n final state, in this case will be the ground state, and minus one on n squared, which is a ninth. Then you get de Broglie's equation. Lambda equals h on mv, that is a matter wave, and matter has a momentum of mv. And so if things slow down, let's be absolutely brutally honest about this. If something slows down to zero velocity, right, it grows to infinite wavelength. Now, this in fact is kind of true. Like, I don't know how much you can slow something down, but if you get a helium and slow it right down, it actually grows and grows in size till you can actually see it. Or you get a cesium or a rubidium atom, and you slow it right down, it goes into what's called a boson condensate. Now, it's here where I'll read the question again one by one and then answer them. A photon is emitted when an electron in a hydrogen atom transitions from the n equals 3 excited state to the ground state. For 2 marks, calculate the wavelength of the photon. So for that, I would just put in the Rydberg equation, and I put lambda equals 1 on the Rydberg constant, 1 minus a ninth, which is 1 minus a ninth is 8 ninths in there. So convert that across to get an answer. And do I have the answer that they've given for 2 answers? Shows partial substitution of a relevant formula. So you just can't write the formula, you have to do it. Using Rydberg equation, they say apply the formula. It's 1027 nanometers. So you'd get the answer out there in nanometers. It's interesting that they've got the subscript there, Rydberg, for the hydrogen atom. Of course, there's I think it's you integrate, you multiply the Rydberg number by z squared to get it correct, z squared being the atomic number. Okay, now this is the next one, which I'm going to put into the firmly into the blooper thing. A photon is incident on a hydrogen in the ground state. Explain using de Broglie's hypothesis why the photon is not absorbed by the hydrogen atom. Well, all I can say is that hydrogen atoms do absorb photons in general, but the particular photon in question, I can guarantee you, as a laser physicist, it's called resonant absorption. That is, it's a light. It's the most amazing thing. So this, and this, you get this problem. Of course, you're measuring the ground, these transitions to the ground state and a gas, and you measure, the lifetime of your upper state. So you hit it with a pulse, say I don't know, a very short pulse of energy from a beam or electrical beam, a very short pulse. It hits, it ionizes the gas, or it directly excites the state, and then you watch how long it takes to decay. This one of the things you do know, you notice, is that it takes a long time to decay because it gets resonantly absorbed. Now there would be there are reasons that the absorption slows down. Say if you heat up the gas, or the gas, you get recoil effect, so you don't get less resonant effects than hydrogen. But it's definitely there that the photon does get absorbed because you can just time reverse the process. There's nothing time dependent on the actual process. You can just rewind the process, so it definitely will get absorbed. Now the Drolli hypothesis only states that the electron is in the particular orbital, but it just happens to fit in with the to be consistent with Bohr's model, but it's not really ever been used in anger in physics. But let's read. It says, provides a clear explanation using Drolli's hypothesis. I wouldn't have survived this. Okay, so I answer questions and then we see the actual answer. The Drolli hypothesis is based on the notion that stationary states are analogous to standing waves. Good. The stationary state will relate to a particular wavelength, and each standing wave will be an integer multiple of the ground state wavelength. Okay, now that happens to be, I'll put it up in that bloopers thing, that happens to be true. Good for a number of reasons. So it's a little bit more complicated. The radius goes up as 1 on n squared, so it goes 1, 4, 9, 16, 25, 36, 49, 64, oh, 81, 100, I suppose. Yeah, that's right. Okay, it goes up like that. And your velocity reduces as 1 on n, and so your wavelength increases as 1 on n. So it just so happens that, you know, the radius is increasing, that 2 pi r is increasing as n squared. The radius, the wavelength increases as 1 on n, so you need n wavelengths around. It's rather a complicated thing to get, so it's not an easy thing to get. This can be mathematically described by the quantization of angular momentum based on de Broglie's wave particle duality symbol. Now, look, what I'm going to say is this is just complete. I'll talk about it a bit later. Lambda equals h on mv, right? And hence, mvr equals h on 2 pi. So yeah. Okay, so there is a sort of quantization. That's all back to front. Bohr postulated that electrons could only exist in defined stationary states, and that electrons can only transition from one state to another if the initial energy allowed the electron to occupy the state that was a multiple of the ground state. Right. The major thing is it doesn't. It shows some understanding, for 2 marks, shows some understanding of de Broglie's hypothesis and or why the photon is not absorbed. Okay, so that gets us there. We've got to read our next question there. Sorry about that. I'll put that in the bloopers page. I've now worked out how to work out. And so what's going to happen here is that we'll get Australian scientists commenting in onto the bloopers page, and we might get some action. We might write a letter to our local minister and say, look, we've got to change this all. We're hurting our Australian students. B. Outline why gravitational forces are irrelevant in the nucleus of an atom. So for this, you would say that in the nucleus of an atom, it comes of neutrons and protons. The protons, proton has the Coulombic force, and neutron, proton, and the other neutrons and protons have the strong nuclear force. That's they're all orders of magnitude greater, and I'll probably quote the G, the size of G there. Okay, let's read what they say. Now, bear in mind, I, in general, now I'm beginning to have a bit of a read of what they say before I go, but not too much. Newton's law of universal gravitation says there's a force of attraction between all types of matter, including the particles of the nucleus. However, the force is overwhelmingly weak compared to the electrostatic forces between the protons. Yet the nucleus remains stable instead of forcing the particles apart. Given the disproportionate nature of the forces, two forces, there must be another, much stronger force involved ensuring the stability of the nucleus. Okay, no comment on that one. Okay, now, the graph shows the binding energy per nucleon. This is up on the website. Now, using the diagram, explain how the energy may be released in a nuclear reaction. Okay, so if we so the nuclear reaction changes by fusion, converts a lighter nucleus to a heavier nucleus. Before iron, anything which is added, you add two nuclei together. The total energy per nucleon can be calculated, and there's a certain number of nucleons. At the other end, you've got iron, which has the same number of nucleons, but a greater energy per nucleon because therefore energy is released. So you might, you have to use the diagram, it says, using the diagram. So if I put four heliums, four hydrogens together to make a helium, I will release 7 MeV. However, I can go the opposite. I can cause uranium to fission, and which has an energy of 7 MeV, and produce two particles of say 20 and 60, roughly, or 26 and 60, and they have a net energy for to a nucleon, which is bigger. Okay, because it's all right. This is interesting here. This is the answering screen for 35. Clearly explain how the energy may be released in a nuclear reaction with reference. It's got to be with reference to the diagram. Sample answer. The binding energy of a nucleon is a measure of the strength of the bond between the nuclear force and between a nuclear force and the nucleus. That's what it says. Okay. For a typical nucleus, that doesn't make sense. What's the strength between a force and a nucleus? That just doesn't make sense. For a typical nucleus, the binding energy is equivalent to the mass defect by the formula equals mc squared. Okay, well, you put delta defect mass squared. For elements below iron, the joining together of atoms produces nuclear, or you say this is wrong, it's not atoms, nucleons, produces nuclei with a higher binding energy per nucleon producing energy. Oh, so if you bind together atoms, per nucleon, this is called nuclear fusion. For elements larger than iron, they split to a new smaller nuclei. The binding energy per nucleon is greater than the average binding energy, gaining and releasing energy. This is called fission. This is interesting here that they actually don't refer to the diagram. Okay, so that's a summary of it. I'm hoping that this is a faster talk. There's less chat with it. I'm going to talk with it around. What I've done is gone through. I'm up to the fifth generation, and just to go on the fifth generation. Yes, son.